Hi, and welcome to Voices in the Wilderness, a show on science and faith that addresses questions posed by skeptics, Christians and non-Christians, ones struggling to reconcile science and faith, and those who are deconstructing or reconstructing, or maybe just revisiting some of the things that they learned growing up. We bring various voices and conversations to open paths for those who wander to connect with Jesus on their journey. If you're watching on Facebook or on YouTube Live, please ask questions or shoot us a comment in the text chat boxes and we'll try to address them, and we love to hear from you. Today we have special guest Dr. Abram Bixler. Dr. Bixler is the president of ECHO and earned his doctorate and master's degrees from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in natural resources and environmental sciences with a focus on sustainable cropping systems, and completed his bachelor's degree at Taylor University in environmental science and biology. As a leader and researcher, Dr. Bixler has been published in a number of journals, including Experimental Agriculture, Agronomy for Sustainable Development, Frontiers in Sustainable Food Systems, the Journal of International Agricultural and Extension Education, Ecosystems and People, the International Journal of Development Research, and the Journal of Agricultural Food Systems and Community Development, in addition to contributing to a number of food and agricultural organizations of the United Nations publications. While at FAO, Bixler guided agroecology and sustainable food system initiatives in multiple regions of the world. Before serving in Rome, Bixler led the ECHO Asia Impact Center's international staff team, coordinated and implemented regional networking and training events, initiated research culminating in multiple published studies, planned and began execution of the ECHO Asia Small Farm Resource Center, and grew the capacity of ECHO Asia Seed Bank. Thank you for joining us. What an impressive resume. We're glad that you could be with us today.
Thanks, Christine. I'm glad to be here.
So, I mean, aside from your impressive resume, tell us a little bit about your background, both academic and spiritual.
Sure. They're very intertwined, actually. So I grew up as the first generation to grow up off of a farm in the United States. So my parents both grew up on small farms in the Midwest. And I also grew up as the first child to be born into a Christian home. So my parents did not grow up. They grew up as just cultural Christians, but they didn't know the Lord. And so I grew up both in those two things, which have intersected my whole life. So I grew up into a Christian family and fell in love with agriculture. It was actually horticulture and growing plants, really for landscaping. And so I ventured into that as a high schooler and wanted to do landscape architecture. I wanted to plan and implement landscapes and integrate them with building design. And had dreams, had aspirations of going to Chicago, starting a firm, making it big, living the American dream. Sure, I was a Christian and I, you know, wanted to follow Jesus and do that, but I also really wanted to make it big on my own. And I ended up at a school called Taylor University in Indiana, out in the rural countryside on a little postage stamp of land. And the closest thing that they had to landscape architecture was environmental science. So I went to Taylor, never having left the country, barely having left Illinois, where I'm from. I'd been around the U.S. a little bit, but not much. And my first class was an introduction to environmental science class. And this was back when we were still under the Millennium Development Goals, the Brundtland Report by the UN, which really established this term of sustainable development, had just been codified, had just been ratified by UN member countries. And so I went into this class completely ignorant about the world around us and the relationship between humans and the environment, and that we need the environment to live and to thrive and survive. And I also went to Taylor completely ignorant about missions, about the least reached people groups in the world and the need for the gospel to be integrated with our professions to reach the world, to reach the lost. And so I was in this environmental science class and I was super depressed because it was all about the 2 billion people at the time who didn't have access to clean water, the billion people who were hungry every single night, those living on less than a dollar a day, the environmental pollution, climate change, the ozone layer was a big deal then too. And so just super depressed about this. Simultaneously, I started learning about the world and the gospel and how God's desire is for humankind to be back in right relationship with him through the gospel, but also to be stewards of the creation, because the creation is what we depend on, and that God owns and cares for the creation, the natural world around us, the entire universe, and loves it and cares for it. And so these two things came together in a major epiphany. And so turns out I had thought about what I wanted to do, but I never asked God what he wanted to do with my life. And so the next thing I knew, I was really getting interested in what it looked like to do what I would call transformational integral mission well. That is using your skills, profession, your passions and desires for the mission field, whether it's locally, nationally, or internationally. And so that led me on that journey that I'm still on, that you read a little bit about in my bio, where faith has influenced what I study, and what I study has influenced my faith as well in integral ways.
We are live with Dr. Abram Bixler. We are live on both YouTube and Facebook. And if you'd like to make a comment or you have a question for the good doctor, we'd love to include you. So I just wanted to let you both know that everything's going good technical wise. And I didn't mean to interrupt your conversation. Do you have anything in response to that, Christine?
Oh, well, sure. I was thinking when I was in ninth grade, I did a science project for the school science fair. And I grew, the plan was to grow 100 African violets, and I had them divided with two types of soil, fertilizers, and two types of lighting to see which combination would be best. And that after like 3 months, I was going to evaluate how they grew. And I successfully killed 97 of them, of the 100. So this was my clue to not do anything related to growing or biology. And so that's why I went into aerospace engineering, because sure, we can kill people when we crash our planes, but it's not so your fascination with landscape architecture and growing things is just like polar opposite of mine. But I too felt God calling me and combining my faith and my education and background too. So I guess in the opposite direction. But for people who, oh, go ahead, John.
I just, one of the things you said that I found rather fascinating, Doctor, and I talk to a lot of people in ministry who sometimes get overwhelmed by it, that just this burden of how many of our brothers and sisters around the world just don't have it as good as we do and are struggling for even clean water and so forth. We're seeing now here out in the West and in Phoenix and in certainly in California, just this preponderance of homelessness has increased greatly since COVID and now with inflation. So I would like to ask you personally, you said that it wasn't long after you felt that burden that you became a Christian or were introduced to the gospel. How do you keep from sliding down into despair when you see the numbers and you see the struggle and all the different areas in which maybe we're falling short to our fellow human beings?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's both a technical and a spiritual component too. One is that, well, part of it was I started my career in academia and to study abroad school, but also working with NGOs. And so part of it is just seeing, and I get to see this every day in my job here at Echo, is to see the hope and the difference that simple options that are rooted in context, and I'm talking from a sustainable production food point of view, but there are simple options out there. And just seeing that, you know, NGOs, agricultural missionaries, But also on the political side, countries are making a difference with farmers, with one farmer here, one farmer there. I mean, not dissimilar from our spiritual experience, in that we, you know, there are people group movements that happen when the gospel, but more often than not, it's one person sharing the gospel with another, bringing the hope of eternity, but also hope for here and now to one person. So I think that is one thing to remember, is to look for those bright spots, those lighthouses, as you hear these experiences from a technical side of things. I've also seen that, you know, from the political side, I worked at the United Nations for 4 years in the agroecology and sustainable food systems, and I just saw that, you know, those NGOs, those agricultural missionaries, those people on the ground are effecting change, one person, one farmer, one community by community. But there's also need for political change, that policy, whether it's well-intentioned but in the end is misguided because of unintended consequences, or from the beginning is really data-driven and well-intentioned and well-guided that elicits change. We need both of those things in order to scale out and scale up hope, and scale out and scale up good policy for the creation, for the environment that benefits people's lives as well. Spiritual component of that, I think, you know, it can be overwhelming when we look around us. And, you know, we work in sustainable agriculture. And so, you know, the most glaring statistic is that there's 828 million hungry people as of November. Food and Agriculture puts out those stats. Going to bed hungry tonight, 828 million people. Right here in this country, about 10% of our population, or about 32 million people, are hungry. So those can get overwhelming. I think that one of the things that we have to focus and turn our eyes on is the hope that we have in Christ, the hope that we see as the church is moving forward, as individuals and sometimes people movements are coming into contact with the gospel and their lives are changing completely, not just the spiritual life, but the way that then that blossoms and blooms and changes our worldview in terms of how we relate with other human beings and how we relate to the social structure, that we fight for justice and equality, that our economics change, that we are impacted multidimensionally because of the gospel. And I think one thing that is encouraging and gives me hope is to look around and see that the church is global in nature. Much of the church has already shifted to the global south, you know, in terms of, I think it's easy to forget this as North Americans, but that, you know, the church in Ghana, in Nigeria, in Brazil, and even China is moving forward, is integrating the gospel in all facets of their life. And things are happening. Things are changing. The church is feeding the poor. They're helping neighbors gain access to water. They're fighting for justice and equality. So I think it's, we have to look at both ends. Both, you can look at it from a technical point of view and see these glimmers of hope. You can look at it from also the church and the spiritual point of view as well, and see these glimmers of hope.
Well, that's really good to hear. I kind of had a discouraging week this week, so hearing about some hope, I think, is refreshes me anyway.
Well, that's what happens when you get 10 more inches of snow, Christine. Well, the doctor and I are basking in the sun in our t-shirts.
Yeah, that is definitely a part of it. Our winter has been excessively harsh. Tell us about ECHO. I bet some of our watchers aren't familiar with your organization. And what is it? Where are you? What do you do? Give us kind of the scoop.
Great. Yeah, so ECHO is a global Christian organization. We've been around for 42 years this year. And we are a technical resourcing and networking organization. And what I mean by that is that we work through a network of about 18,500 organizations and individuals who are working with the poor on the ground. So these include diverse groups of actors. These include large Christian Relief and Development Organization. They include local NGOs, non-governmental organizations, include agricultural missionaries. They include some farmers, farmers cooperatives, government extension agents, and increasingly the local church. We see a lot of local church members and leaders joining ECHO. So we have a global network. And what we do is that we are looking for options. I use that word a lot because in agriculture, there's no such thing as a silver bullet. Soil types and the climate and the water availability and the plant types and the cuisine of culture changes way too much as you move across the landscape. So we look for options that are low cost but high effect that work well in particular contexts. And we look for those options. We research them or join with others who are researching them to validate those options. And then we disseminate. That's a fancy extension word for we share. We share those options through our network. And then we try to measure the impact of those. So if you know the extension system in the United States, which almost every county has an extension agent, and that person is linked to the university, and the university is researching plants, crops, cropping systems, ideas, solutions for farmers and home gardeners, and sharing that knowledge with them. That's basically what we're doing for the world. And tangibly, the way that we do that is that we have four offices globally. I'm in the headquarters in the North America Regional Impact Center here in Fort Myers, Florida. So if you're around, come and visit us. We also have a center in Chiang Mai, Thailand, serving Asia. We have one in Arusha, Tanzania, serving East Africa. And we have one in Burkina Faso, serving all of West and Francophone Africa. And so across these four regions, what we're doing is trying to make sure that different solutions, ideas, options, plants are being contextualized. So they need to be localized. We need to make sure that they work both for the ecology, the underlying ecology of the place, as well as the underlying culture of the place. And so we have about 80 staff total around the world with more regional impact centers to come. And it's really our joy and our goal to equip and empower our network. And every single month through echocommunity.org, which is our technical resourcing platform, we have 40 years of information on there. Every single month, we have just about every country in the world accessing our information, exchanging ideas and questions with one another, coming and learning about our events. So we do workshops, we do conferences, we host online trainings, we have videos, we put out technical extension pieces, ECHO development notes, as well as regional supplements to that, as well as a whole host of other mechanisms for us sharing these options that provide hope to the hungry. So we are not a development organization. We don't do projects on the ground. We don't, we're not a mission sending agency. We are a Christian not-for-profit that it's equipping a very diverse network of organizations and individuals. And behind me, you can see some of the end users, if you will, that are being impacted through our network of incredible people and incredible organizations.
You know, I just want to chime in. Christine, you got a personal comment here from YouTube. Somebody wanted to defend you and say, but you successfully grew all the flesh floral centerpieces for your wedding, Christine.
That is true.
Okay.
So that's impressive.
It was a rainy summer and we were moving them out in the sun every time the sun came out and pulling them back into the overhang from the house to prevent them from washing away. Yeah, that's true.
So there's even hope for us who aren't.
I had help.
I kind of have a theological question for you on this one. And that is, when you speak of the church, I could tell you're speaking globally, and there are great things that are happening. One of, I think, the big pluses with sharing the gospel is the generosity of many Christian communities around the world, you know, where meeting the needs of those in tragic situations or people who are dealing with lesser means, Christian organizations come to their aid, people collect in churches for them and so forth. But there is a corner of the church, and this might be more of a Western church type of thing, but there's a corner of the church, or at least a corner of Christianity, that their eschatology kind of affects how they live today. And they kind of, I don't want to demean it in a way where I make it a cartoon, but the kind of idea that this isn't our home, we're just passing through. We know it's going to have a fiery end and there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. So aren't we just, you know, kind of repositioning the chairs on the Titanic, right? How does that kind of theology, and what do you do when you meet Christians that feel that the only important thing is really to share the gospel to save a soul for the afterlife, and not to minister to the everyday needs that Christ talked about in the sheep and the goats argument, you know, bringing food to the hungry, visiting those in prison and so forth? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's one that's particularly perplexing among certain sectors of especially American, the American church. As you mentioned, I think that the one of them, this is a great question. I think in terms of there's kind of two ways I think that are helpful for me in my own journey that I've seen, besides really looking at Jesus and his words. I mean, reading the Gospels and having to decide, what do we do with this guy? And do we take his words seriously, you know, about the Beatitudes? And is that something that we really should seriously entertain? So that's something I think different, because I know where I stand on, you know, on Jesus. And yes, we see Jesus, you know, healing the sick, feeding the hungry, as well as preaching the gospel when necessary. I love St. Francis of Assisi and his take on that, which is preach the gospel and use words whenever necessary. So besides whether or not people take Jesus and him seriously and the Old Testament seriously as well, in terms of, you know, there's so much in the Old Testament about care for the land and about reallocation of the land for the year of Jubilee and setting captives free and all these things which are in the Old Testament. I think if we can move it out even to kind of a larger set of issues, and that is, what do we do about creation care, and also it's a neighbor issue. So for creation care, you know, I think early on when we look at Genesis and wherever people are coming from their interpretation of Genesis, I think that when we look at God putting Adam and Eve in the garden and telling them to abad and to shamar the garden, which is to care for and keep the garden, there's a precedence for creation care, that there's a linkage between humankind and our sustenance being derived from the creation, and God really giving this order to care for and keep the creation. There's also, you know, when the animals pass by Adam, he's told to name the animals. My understanding of that is that it's a very deep-seated, intimate knowledge that you have to do something in the Hebrew mind as monumental as naming. It's like naming a child, right? So I think another part in terms of the eschatological and how we view the end times is hugely important. I think that's a huge problem within especially the evangelical church here in this country. Someone that treats this really well would be a future great guest for your show is Reverend Dr. Dave Bookless. He's the head of theology at Arosha organization that works in creation care. And they help to really help church members. They help believers try to think about the creation and what does it mean to abad and shamar the creation. And I love what Dave has to say about this. He says that often in English we have the word new, and I apologize to Dave if I butcher this. That's why you need to have him on the show. But we have the word for new, and it's very limited. We automatically think brand spanking new, but it's more nuanced in the Greek. And so anytime in the New Testament we hear new in English, It's actually nuanced between neos or kainos. And there's these two Greek words. And neos means, you know, ex nihilo, out of nothing, brand new. Whereas kainos means refreshed, renewed, restored, and even connotations of recycling. And so a lot of times when I hear passages that are used, you know, oh, well, it's all going to burn anyway because Jesus says, behold, I'm making all things new, and there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. It's not the neos word. It's actually kainos, that this idea of refreshed, renewed, glorified, just like our bodies will be, that they will be without sin and renewed and glorified. And that's why it'd be great to have Dave on the show, but I think it's just a major point that needs to be discussed more. And then to tie it into this neighbor issue, you know, I think that really for the first time ever, I mean, the last 50 years, we see the finiteness of our home and that there's no plan B. This is it. That this world is our life system. It is our physical life system. And that we're connected to everybody in this world now through transboundary pollution and through issues like ozone layer depletion and climate change. And so when we pollute, when we add carbon and methane into the atmosphere, using climate change as an example of that, we are affecting people all around the world. That the Bangladeshis are experiencing worse flooding and starvation and death as a result of our actions, even though we're 8,000, 10,000 miles away. And so it comes back to, what do we do with our neighbor? And who is our neighbor? Just like Jesus, you know, confronted his audience with this idea of the Samaritan. Who is your neighbor? And I think nowadays we have to be confronted with this idea of, is our neighbor global? And I think unequivocally, absolutely, our neighbors are global. And we have a calling as a church, if we're serious about loving our neighbor, it's not just in our Jerusalem and Judea, but it's in our Samaria. And it's in the ends of the earth, quite literally, that we are having an impact.
Before I go back to dear Christine, I do have another question to share with you from online. Dr. Clark Van Gilder has asked, how well is the opportunity for creation care realized in ECHO's outreach and support? For example, having more small, decentralized farms versus miles of monocrops such as we have in the USA?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Dr. Clark. It's a great question. And one of the ways that we go about doing that is, as we're a global organization, most, not all, but most of our focus is on the global south, the global majority world, where the greatest numbers of acute and chronic malnutrition are. And one of the ways we realize creation care is by training, by equipping local church leaders, agricultural missionaries, by working with organizations like Arosha, by working with other organizations who are working through the church to bring about creation care. And agriculture is fascinating because it is one of the only spheres that is entirely dependent upon the resources on which it depends, and it has, you know, tremendous opportunity to destroy those resources as well as conserve and improve those resources. You're absolutely right in terms of helping farmers stay on small farms, making small farms more productive, both here in the U.S. as well as globally. This is part of my work. It was part of my work at the United Nations, was through agroecology, better connecting consumers to farms, helping farmers, the youth, stay on the farms, making those farms more sustainable across economic, social, and environmental dimensions. And the U.S. has a long way to go, you know, in terms of we work with some local partners here in Fort Myers, Florida, to help with food security of some of our local neighbors. But there's also a policy dimension to this. And even though I worked in policy at the U.N., ECHO doesn't work in policy now, but there's a hugely important area for Christians to be involved. And this is what I think one of my points that I like to impact on students, are either our interns and students in universities, is that the world now more than ever has the need for transdisciplinary approaches. We can't be in our silos, but we have to work across the disciplines. The natural science and the social science, the economic sciences all need to work together. And there's a tremendous potential for Christians using all of our professions, using all of our backgrounds to help elicit things like policy change, to help elicit things like better economics for smallholder farms, both in this country as well as around the world. So back to ECHO, we work through our network. It is a joy and a desire when we see network members who are already doing good work, when they're equipped and empowered to do even better work through sustainable agriculture and through creation care, through just trainings and encouragement on creation care.
So how does the ECHO Impact Centers contextualize the needs in the regions they serve? And like, what makes a plant sustainable and desirable for food production? And like, give us some examples of sustainable food systems, because like I said, plants aren't my area of expertise.
One of the things I love about agriculture, and even the word agriculture, is that it has connotations of cultivation and caring for, and it has an idea of ecology to it, but it also has this idea of culture to it. And even in the United States, we have very different ecologies and very different cultures. Christine, you're experiencing this now. Your ecology is, you have 10 inches of snow, and you're not going to be growing crops, whereas I'm in Fort Myers, Florida, and we're at a heat index of 89 degrees today. Same country, totally different ecologies. Likewise, culture plays a huge impact because culture is related to nutrition, it's related to cuisine, it's related to the way we build our houses and the way that we clothe ourselves, the way that we cook our food, the plants that we, over 10,000 years of agriculture, have chosen for the texture and the flavors and the way that we use those plants in the food we make. And so that's vital. That's absolutely essential. And one of the ways that ECHO goes about doing that, the reason we have impact centers, is so that they can be contextualized in the different ecologies and the different cultures around the world to make sure that the options, not the solutions, but the options that we're sharing they make sense for the culture and ecology. I think the first and most important starting point is asking the right questions. Asking the questions are, what are the needs? What are, to peel back the layers of the needs, and are those needs physical in a particular place? Are they a result of poor infrastructure? Are those needs a result of nothing grows because my soil has too much salt or the wrong pH? Are those needs more mindset needs? Are they policy needs because there's been the wrong policy and there's no market access, or farmers grow a lot of food, but then they can't sell it in time? So making sure that we ask the right needs. And that's one of the things that we stress with our network members, is making sure you're asking the right needs to help guide the thinking and the thought process behind, okay, so then if I have this suite of needs that are prioritized by the community, what are some options that might help meet those needs? And that's where ECHO shares different options based on where we've seen those options work before. So if you're in Southeast Asia, where I was for 9 years, you know, a big need might be how to connect farmers to better local markets, and how to help farmers grow a more diverse offering of food so that they have a more diversified income year-round as opposed to just growing a monocrop. And so we look for options that might be like, what current plants are there that make up their culture and their cuisine? And are there any emerging plants and foods that might fill a emerging need, an emerging market as well? And then helping our network members test those options low risk in context to see, do they work well? Will they grow well? Will people eat them? Is there a market for them? And what we find is usually that, it's really important to find a positive deviant, to find, I love this idea of a person who moves things in the right direction, but maybe not fully accepted by the community. They're a deviant in that they're willing to take risk. Entrepreneurs are like this in many regards. Finding someone who's willing to take a little bit of risk, maybe the community is a little incredulous about them or their methods, but when they find something that works, it spreads like wildfire. And oftentimes that's one of the best, that's one of the best ways to know that one of these options work is you see farmers adapting the option. You see farmers organically sharing the option within their communities. You see communities sharing these options as well. And we've seen that. We've seen that in some of the perennial vegetables that Echo has made reference to and has found in the past. We see that in different production approaches that work well in particular areas. And so just one piece of the puzzle, but one of the most important things is being humble enough to ask the right questions about the need and then putting communities and individuals in the driver's seat to help determine the ranking of those needs and some of the options that might work to meet those needs.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you have touched on climate change a little bit, and climate change has been occurring for the whole history of the Earth, but now it's being influenced significantly by humans. How are you seeing this impact affect the food source for people around the world?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's a little funny and frightening is that, you know, most places where I've been around the world, rubbing elbows with farmers, many illiterate, many maybe who haven't even had the blessing of even a little bit of education, they're seeing the effects. They're feeling the effects of climate change firsthand. Almost every farmer I asked in Asia when I was there 9 years that I met with, I would ask, have you noticed any differences, you know, since you were a kid or since the elders used to share about growing crops? And everyone would say, yes, we no longer know when to plant our crops. We no longer know when to harvest. The rainfall's erratic. The rainfall used to be consistent. We knew every year, you know, there would be a light rain in March, and then about May, the rains would always come. We knew when to plant our crops. And, you know, the next thing would be, well, what's causing that? And almost unequivocally, farmers would say, it's climate change. The climate is changing. It's happening. And, you know, our crops are failing. We don't know when to plant. The rains are, you know, the rains might come, we plant our seed, and then the rains don't come again for a month later and we've lost our entire crop. Or we plant our crop, the rains are good, but then we get torrential mass flooding and we lose everything. So it's being felt all around the world. It's being felt in this country as well. You know, I'm here in Fort Myers, Florida, and just the intensity and frequency of these storm events is really, really troubling. And you know, the desertification that's happening in some areas as a result of the interactions of human actions, such as overproduction and poor soil management combined with climate change, and then the flooding and landslides happening in other areas because there's too much water and too short of a time period, is also wreaking havoc on our food systems. And from all the data, it's only going to get worse. If you've seen the IPCC report that came out just a few weeks ago, there's still time, but it's grim. The outlook is very, very grim.
I hate to be that guy, but Christine.
Yeah, you're that guy, John.
Christine has the halo and I have the pitchfork. So again, when it comes to climate science, Doctor, a lot of the pushback against it comes from within the church, at least here in the West. There's this idea that it's a political hoax to take control or to separate people from money, or it's anti-capitalist and so forth. And so it's got this political connection in the mind of many of the brethren where they don't even accept the science. And this kind of overlaps into other areas, not simply climate science, but we saw a visceral reaction. A good example would be when even Franklin Graham got on Twitter and said people should get vaccinated. and his own Twitter followers savaged him as a compromiser or something. So when it comes to wearing a mask during a pandemic or getting a vaccine or teaching evolution in a biology class or even the denial of climate science, it seems that a good chunk of the people who are participating in this are Christians. How much of a drag do you think this is on the body of Christ for being that the hands and the feet of Jesus Christ and ministering to the needs of what you mentioned that was kind of God saying, this is what it means to be my imager, that you take care of creation and each other.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a huge distraction and a huge drag, I think, from the realities of the world. And I would like to think that some of that is ignorance and unintentional. I think that there is a moral responsibility issue as well. And I think that oftentimes, when we look at something like climate change, it directly affects and it should make us think about, how am I living my life? And I think one of the visceral reactions, unfortunately, in this country, both inside and outside the church, is that when we're confronted with these issues, that we have this visceral reaction of, I'm not going to change my life for those Bangladeshis over there. People don't say that, but just there's a visceral reaction, because when we're confronted by the way we live our lives, it's really, really challenging and it's really difficult. And I'm as guilty as anyone with this, but I do think there is this issue of moral responsibility that, and to take it back to this creation care issue, that climate change is a creation care issue. It's an issue about how is our eschatology shaped? How do we interpret the word of God, in this neos versus kainos? It's also a creation care issue in that it forces us to look back and at this abad and shamar, and this idea that, are we connected to this earth on which we depend for our oxygen and our water and our food and our shelter? And what are we going to do with that if we are? I think it's also, and probably more constructively, a neighbor issue. I think it's a neighbor issue. Like I mentioned before, that we've seen the finite scope of our world. We know, we're starting to learn some of the boundary conditions of ecosystems and the feared ecosystem collapse that is coming if we don't change the way we live our lives from the overuse of natural resources, that ecosystems will collapse. And unfortunately, they're going to collapse first in those places where we have the most vulnerable. And the most vulnerable are the first ones to be impacted by climate change, ecosystem collapse, ecosystem degradation. And why? Because of overconsumption. I think that's the other critical component. And there's a moral responsibility there. Of most of these issues are driven by overconsumption. To think that, our population, which makes up about 5% of the total world's population, and yet we consume a far greater percentage than that. And that in a lot of ways, we've already overstepped our planetary boundaries due to overconsumption. And so I think to link back to my faith and my technical journey, I think that class was in all gloom and doom, thankfully. As the gospel is not gloom and doom, but we need the gloom and doom to get to the point of what's going to change. And the gospel is what brings us what's going to change. In the same way, that class on environmental science wasn't all doom and gloom. It ended with practical ways that we are making a difference, not to the scale that we need, but that practical ways people and the church can make a difference in their day-to-day living. And what struck me is, I think the takeaway was that simple living, trying to bring down our consumption, trying to push off consumerism and say, things are not going to make me happy. What's going to make me happy is being in relationship with God and being in relationship with other people and being in relationship and enjoying the creation as we enjoy our Creator. And so the end of that class, I think simple living was the key takeaway message for that class. And I think one of the neat things that's emerging in the church, that's emerging in the millennial generation is that, and I think I've seen this in the baby boomers and some of the older generations, is that they've lived in an era of plenty, especially in this country, lived in an era of plenty, and yet they're not happy. The stuff, the second and third houses, the fancy cars haven't made them happy. They've made them scared and fearful about the future. And I think one of the neat things I'm seeing is that I think that we're seeing more of that in millennials, more of that in the younger generations, as they've seen their parents race after these things and not be content by them. And so I'm hopeful that we will get back to a point of just asking, when is enough? It's, you know, living simple so that other people can simply live. And I think that's a message of hope for the church as well. And just really looking at the disciplines and the things that can bring us joy is about relationships with God and each other and the creation as well.
Yeah, I think even just being less wasteful, there's so much waste. I know our family, we're doing some kitchen remodel and have been without appliances, which is a little bit stressful. And we've been eating out more often than normal, and the portion sizes are so huge, and we have been trying to split food, split meals, just so that there's not so much waste. What are some really practical tips aside from simple living and being less wasteful? What are practical tips that we can do at a family level to be better stewards of our natural resources?
Mm-hmm. I do want to pick up on the waste thing a little bit, since I work in agriculture, and you're absolutely right that waste, consumer waste is a huge problem in this country, but food waste as well. And globally, about a third of our total food is lost or wasted. In the developing world, It's loss. It never makes it to the consumer to eat because there's a breakdown in cold chain and value chain. In the developed world, most of ours is waste. We have a really good cold chain, but then it's left in the refrigerator, or it rots because it's not perfect enough looking at the grocery store, so it gets thrown away. So, you know, that's a 30% of the food that we grow is loss or wasted. So that's a huge starting point. I think the other aspect to that is this idea of circular economy, and that has ecosystem ramifications as well. Reducing our waste to begin with, but then what do we do with the waste? So, you know, simple ways, we need to look at humanure. We need to shorten those nutrient cycling loops. Healthy ecosystems take the waste and recycle it into nutrients for plants. It's just that simple. Animals are a great nutrient cycler of that. Humans are a great nutrient recycler as well. So we need to, reduce what we buy to begin with. We need to recycle the things that we can't, you know, reduce the waste from. And we need to make sure that waste, whether it's humanure, whether it's compostable food scraps, make it back to the land. I think another really practical way is for people to live lower on the food chain. Some of my colleagues working with livestock will disagree with me. I think livestock are absolutely essential in the food system. We need to eat less meat in the developed world. We need animals, but we need to reconnect animals and the crops as they are in healthy ecosystems. So one way to do that is we need to relocalize ourselves to our food. So buying more local food, growing food yourself are really simple ways. I love what's happening with different green and renewable technologies for energy efficiency in this country is very great. We need to shift towards renewables as well. We need to reduce the amount of energy we consume in the first place, but shifting towards renewables. And we've seen, I mean, there's some really promising signs about that. Using less water and using water more wisely is absolutely essential as well. Water is going to be one of the, it's already one of the key components of agriculture. Agriculture uses about 70% of freshwater withdrawals, both surface and underground globally. And much of that's lost to evaporation. And so we need far more efficient ways of growing our food. And part of that is eating lower on the food pyramid and on the trophic levels, but it's also eating more closely, knowing your farmer, using less transportation costs for that. So those are just a few of the simple ways, especially from an agricultural point of views, in which we can be better stewards of what God has given us.
Well, you mentioned water and earlier desertification. Is ECHO involved with desertification counter efforts like the Great Green Wall in the Sahara and Sahel?
Some of our members in our network would be from that, you know, it's very high level political country driven. FAO is a part of that. We're more in the practical options side of things. So reforestation, some of our partners are doing reforestation. In East Africa, we have a partnership with some local NGOs to reforest some of the local mountainscapes. So reforestation, there are a lot of options out there for better water management. So using the water that you have wisely, sand dams, crescents, there's a technique called Foundations for Farming, which has spread like wildfire in West and Sub-Saharan Africa. And it's this idea of using planting pits and putting compost into the pit, mulching that, and planting every year back in that same pit. And the overarching idea is reduce your water consumption, reduce your fertility. So instead of fertilizing the whole plot, you're putting the fertilizer right where the plant roots need it. So we're not doing things with the Great Green Wall per se, but a lot of the options that we share, that we look at, that we validate, we demonstrate, do have ramifications for water use efficiency. Things like bucket drip kits and even placement of kitchen gardens close to the home. If people are accessing potable water for cooking and cleaning and washing, planting a kitchen garden right outside your back door reduces your labor, because then you could take all your gray water and put it right on your plants, but then also helps with your home food security. So some of these really simple but really profound options are we're learning from our network, and we're also sharing with our network.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did a couple of short-term mission trips in Honduras, and one of the things that we were partnering with an organization there, and they were working on this aquaponic system where they were growing tilapia in this tank, and then they were taking the fishy water and running that through gardens and then capturing it back up to recycle into the tilapia tanks, and hoping to increase the nutrition of the people in that community, because they would eat the tilapia and then the vegetables and conserve the water. So that was really interesting. And they were still building it when I was there.
That's cool. Yeah, aquaponics, wow. It's a great approach, especially in places that don't have a lot of water.
Yeah. I mean, they do have water in Honduras, but it's kind of like the oceans are salty. So some of the water isn't like really usable for planting for plants. So I once saw a sci-fi show where these evil villains break into the seed bank and they're destroying a bunch of important seeds. And I know ECHO has a seed bank. And I'm sure that the sci-fi show that I was watching was not necessarily very accurate. So, you know, tell us, what are seed banks exactly, and what kind of seeds do you keep or store or produce, or how does that all work? And do people, if it's a bank, do people deposit and withdraw from it? What are seed banks?
That's a great question. So when Echo started, one of the first thing our president and founder, Dr. Martin Price, did was realize there are a lot of neglected and underutilized, that is, crops that are either have been forgotten about or not used to their full potential all around the world. And so 42 years ago, he started actually a global seed bank here on the campus of Echo, Florida. And the idea was to have a place where seeds of merit, of plants of merit, could be propagated and shared with those as working around the world as a potential option to help improve food security, to help improve nutritional security and livelihoods. And so we still have a seed bank here. We work with the USDA for making sure everything's phytosanitary. But one of the neat things about having different offices around the world is that those offices have seed banks as well. And what a seed bank is it doesn't even need to be a structure. It just needs to be really an idea and a purpose-driven approach to saving your healthiest, best seeds from certain varieties of plants, hopefully that you like to eat and have good ability for growing and adaptation across ecosystems, purposefully saving those seeds so that you have resilience baked into your system. The broader benefit of seed banks is that a bank, whether it is a physical structure or it's above someone's fire, as we had in Thailand, people save their seeds. Most farmers save their seeds when they can. But treating those seeds well, storing them well, so that you have the opportunity to use those seeds years down the road. Another aspect of a seed bank is a seed bank gives you the ability to share your seeds with other community members. It gives you also the ability to mix up the biodiversity upon which agriculture depends, especially in the face of climate change and changing ecosystems as well. So now we have seed banks in 3 out of 4 of our offices. They're very simple. Some are just refrigerated rooms, and we use vacuum sealing because we've done a lot of research on seed banking and how to best preserve and save seeds across the years. And we found out that vacuum sealing works really well for that. Vacuum sealing with low temperatures. And so not only are we saving seeds of merit and finding seeds of merit and sharing those with our network members, but we are also, based on our knowledge and research that we've done on best practices for seed banking, we're also sharing that training with others in our network. So it's great to have an in situ seed bank for resilience. You know, the USDA maintains a global repository of seed banks in the U.S., of all of our crop germplasm. There's also the Global Seed Vault in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle for countries to actually store their seeds basically on ice to provide resilience. But we do have seed banks that are physical locations, but we also increasingly are training our network members because it's important not only to have in situ seed storage, it's also important that seeds are grown and plants are grown every year. So ex situ in different locales. So if farmers and communities and network members can do a better job of saving their seeds in their own countries, in their own communities, and we can create a network of like-minded seed banks, then we're creating more resilience all around. So that's a big point that you're going to see Echo doing more in the future, is equipping those in our network to better be able to care for and keep and store their seeds. And also to just this idea of your plants are only as good as the adaptation that they're encountering every year. And it's really neat. Again, back to agriculture, the culture and the ecology piece. When you plant crops that are open pollinated, we could get into hybrids versus open pollinated another time. But when you plant crops that you're actively saving the seeds for every year, you have two pressures on them. One is an ecosystem pressure. So only the healthiest plants are going to survive due to insects and pests and changing soil types and pH, blah, blah, blah. But the other factor is the human dimension of selecting for those plants that are healthiest, that are the biggest, that have the biggest fruit, that taste the best. Even as cuisine and culture shifts and changes and the ecology shifts and changes, farmers are an integral part of shaping both the ecology and the culture. And so saving seed has allowed agriculture to work for 10,000 years. Helping with seed banks is giving humankind the ability to build more resilience into our system for the next 10,000 years to come. Sad thing is that we've already lost 75% of the cultivated plant varieties upon which agriculture depends and helped to evolve in the last 100 years. So It's, again, a huge issue. We've lost an incredible array of biodiversity, crop biodiversity.
Okay, so I have this crazy question. So I know tobacco plants are often used for research, and of course they're used for cigarettes, tobacco production, and various forms of smoking. Would it be helpful if some of these crops could be replaced by sustainable, nutrition-rich options instead?
That's a tough question, because to everything in agriculture there is a social and economic and an environmental sustainability piece. So, I think ideally in an ideal world, if those, I don't want to call them vice crops, but, crops that often serve a very important economic dimension, whether it's opium, which is illegal to grow in most places, or tobacco in others, which have negative social ramifications for them. In an ideal world, there would be a place to have a shift towards more nutrition dense foods that are important for the families that grow them, as well as for the global food cycle. I think the thing that makes that difficult is that there's a demand side to vice crops like tobacco, opium, etc. And so I think it just shows the transdisciplinary and integral piece that some of these crops really have, that there's a strong market for that. I think another thing that's interesting to ponder is just, the amount of grain that goes into making things like alcohol. How much grain in terms of barley and other malted grains are used for things like alcohol that aren't necessarily feeding people per se, but for recreation and for these other types of crops. Now, the difficult and the complicated part of that is that there's a market for those sorts of things, and farmers are going to grow what the market demands. So there's a moral side of things, but there's also the policy side and the social side of these things, which I think comes back again to agriculture. I have a black screen. There we go.
Well, you sure sound passionate about all this, and it's been fascinating, really interesting. I understand that Echo gives tours if you're ever in the Fort Myers area. Is that right? You have like a bunch of different climate areas where you have different like temperate zones and rainforests and that sort of thing. Would you just kind of wrap it up for us with the final, how would we learn more or get in contact with Echo or come visit you? What would we see? Just tell us a little bit more about Echo.
Sure. So we do offer tours in the Fort Myers campus, and we have tours Tuesday through Saturday. So if you're in the area, you can come and take a tour and learn all about Echo. You will go and visit our global farm, which recreates 8 different ecosystems from around the tropical, subtropical world. So you can learn more about Echo that way. All of our funding comes from donors. So the generosity of about between 3,000 and 4,000 donors, churches, and a couple of foundations keep Echo running our entire global operation. So we're a pretty lean, mean, but effective machine. And if you want to learn more, you can get on www.echonet.org. If you would like more on the technical side of things, you can visit echocommunity.org. So echonet.org and echocommunity.org to learn all about us. And you'll also find our other 3 centers and where they're located in case you're visiting either Tanzania, Burkina Faso, or Thailand and would like to go visit them.
We've just gone over an hour, and I know Christine promised that was the last question, but I'm going to break that promise and just say it kind of piggybacks to the question she just asked you. But I can imagine somebody just listening to this interview, and maybe they weren't aware of all this, or maybe they were coming out of that circle that didn't think this kind of thing was important or could be connected to their spiritual life. I wonder if you could give a few examples of what, let's say, say that person was me. What can I do as a father? What can our household do? And I'm going to take a couple things off the table for you because we've already talked about them. For example, waste less and consume less, and possibly support financially ECHO. I'm going to take those three things off the table. Give me some other practical advice that I can do now that could start meeting this kind of a need.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one, if you're a person of faith, is to pray for the organizations that are working all around the world to try to elicit this change. Pray for your church and church members to have an epiphany about the state of the world, but also the impact that the gospel has. Be a voice for creation care in your church. There's some great organizations that are doing this. There's some, and I can share some links with you, John and Christine, later to share with your groups. But be a voice of creation care. On our website, we have the biblical basis for ECHO's ministry, and it touches on creation care. It touches on neighbor issues. Be that voice in the wilderness, calling people to repentance, and moving things in the right direction. You know, get to know the local organizations working in your backyard, wherever you are, the soup kitchens, the rescue ministries, the local organizations working to help feed the poor and the hungry, and hopefully it's your church. Hopefully your church has an entry point with that as well. You know, simultaneously, I just try to be local citizens, to be global but also local, thinking, praying, learning about the state of the world, the state of the global church through things like Joshua Project and Operation World, just to see where the church is at globally, but local, in that you're acting local and interacting and trying to make a difference, especially in food security and nutrition. I was shocked. I only found that statistic because I was really curious. I know, having worked with FAO, 828 million people, we've gone backwards. There's more hungry people that have increased over the last 3 to 4 years, but 10% in the United States are hungry. That's about 32 million. Now, the really sad flip side to that is that, you know, there's now more obese and overweight people in the world than there are hungry people in the world. In the U.S., it's about 70% of Americans are obese or overweight. So, you know, praying for our neighbor, helping our neighbor, our neighbors access healthy, nutrition-dense, locally produced food, and helping, and also being a political voice, getting involved politically, helping with, you know, making your voice known for things as an individual with Farm Bill, with food stamps, and helping to ensure that your local communities are making farmers markets available, and that farmers markets are accepting food stamps. It's a huge and easy way. Show up at your city council meetings and encourage them to give a space for local farmers to sell their food and for food stamps to be accepted at your local farmers markets and community-supported agriculture.
Well, thank you for watching, folks, and thank you for joining us as a voice in the wilderness, Dr. Abram Brixler.
Yeah, glad you're here. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.